Good morning. Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Jessen, Werke, and Hooten. The Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second oral argument before us on our calendar today. It is June 3rd, 2020, and the panel is Judge Renee Werke, Judge Carol Hooten, and I'm Lucinda Jessen. This matter is A20-0293, State versus McClatchy. Just as in our physical courtroom, each side will have 15 minutes for their main argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'd ask you to state your name when you begin your argument so that that is clear for our audio recording. And with that, oh, I would note that the clerk will put up a clock, which everyone should be able to see, so that you'll know how much time you have remaining. And with that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Mr. Kleinfelter. May it please the court, Scott Springer for the appellant, State of Minnesota. Whether I need to reserve that 5 minutes or not, I would like to take that 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. As a threshold matter, this is a pretrial appeal by the state. It does require a showing of critical impact on our ability to prosecute the defendant. Dismissal is a critical impact. There are cases cited for that in our brief. Respondent concedes that point. I do need the court to find it as well, but I won't address it any further unless you request that I do. Furthermore, I don't intend to touch much on the propriety of a sua sponte reconsideration motion. Nor do I intend to touch much on questions of judicial impartiality. The reason for that is that I believe the facts of this case are really, and the law related to reasonable articulable suspicion, make this a relatively straightforward case for reversal, making those other questions moot.
But Mr. Springer, if we, you know, if you've raised three issues and of course, one is whether the stop was valid based on the speed as it was entering into a different speed zone. But aren't we aren't going to be trying this case. It wasn't tried to conclusion. We have an omnibus order that was issued, and omnibus orders are issued in 30 days, and on it went, and then it was changed. So how do we deal with that procedural problem?
Well, and that's, Your Honor, again, that gets to the sua sponte reconsideration. We have addressed that in our brief, but I don't think we get to sua sponte reconsideration if we determine that, first of all, the initial order was wrong with regard to reasonable articulable suspicion on the speed issues. Secondly, that it was wrong with regard to, or that the second order was wrong with regard to reasonable articulable suspicion. I don't think we need to get into the procedural issues if we can simply say on the facts that this is reasonable articulable suspicion. Now, I can certainly address that.
But here's what I'm getting at. I'm hung up on the sua sponte nature. If we agree with your argument on that, and we say that Judge Kreitzer did not give notice and an opportunity to argue, don't we send it back so that you have opportunity to argue if he's going to change his mind? I mean, don't we have to start at that threshold?
Your Honor, I do believe, yes, that could be a remand. However, it could be an outright reversal if you determine that there's reasonable articulable suspicion. So I think that we get to the.
I need you to convince me how I can do that, or how the panel can do that, if that's the case.
Well, Your Honor, let's say the judge was just wrong, and hadn't made a second order. If he had made the second order first, we would have been appealing that first order, and the result of the appeal of that order would simply have been reversal. It would not have been a remand. You would have said, no, this is reasonable articulable suspicion, Judge. You looked at it wrong. And so you would have remanded for trial, not remand for reconsideration of the omnibus issues.
You know, could you explain to me procedurally how this would work? If we just say we adopt your first argument, there wasn't notice given and that the second order isn't binding and that the first order stands. I mean, aren't you going to trial? I mean, how would this work out procedurally? I mean, wouldn't it force you to go to trial just on the center line when a judge has already decided that that crossing in the center line, that there's not a, it's not credible?
That's certainly another way to do it. I mean, if you...
You couldn't even bring up the speed, could you?
No, we couldn't, which is why we didn't appeal the first, because there was no critical impact. You know, he was half right on the first order, but it was not appealable. So we didn't have a critical because we didn't have a critical impact.
Okay. So if I had to reword it, then the fact that the second order was issued, basically, if that order eliminated the center line, then it made it a critical impact as to the speed. Am I correct?
Correct. Yes.
Could you have proceeded with a motion for a writ to undo what Judge Kreitzer did? And then you end up going to trial on the remaining criminal charges? I'm really trying to think through this, how we can address these bundled issues.
Well, if we simply take the second order and say, okay, whether the judge could do it or not, let's look at the issues in the second order. Let's look at the facts that the court found and determine whether or not those are reasonable, articulable.
Okay, but it was an order. So what if the judge had issued an order and not dismissing it, but found him not guilty and just skip the trial? We can't just go up the ladder and skip orders and deal with the last one that comes in, frankly, out of the blue, because both of you agree, at least your briefs don't argue that you didn't have any notice of this.
I'm not quite sure what your question is.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that it seems that if we're reviewing the order that was issued, that we have to address the notice and timing of that order. There's no question there.
I understand where you're getting though with that, but assuming arguendo that the second order was properly filed, that the court properly filed the second order. So we assume arguendo that he did and that he could do that. He had discretion to do that. He did it. It was proper. If we assume arguendo that he did, then we look at whether or not that order is correct.
But you've raised in your brief your argument that it was not proper. We have to address that, don't we? I mean, you've asked for alternative relief, which isn't necessarily appropriate in appellate court. But if you've raised the issue and said that it's not right, if you had simply argued the validity of the order and didn't raise the procedural funkiness of this thing, then maybe we could have went your way.
Yes and no. I mean, if you look at the second part of that argument was this appearance of impropriety, Your Honor. And if you look at what the Supreme Court did with Judge Amundson's case, the Powell versus Anderson case, if you look at what the Supreme Court did there, when they said that order was not proper, it should never have been given, Judge Amundson should have been recused. You know, they reversed that order. And so I think, you know, we're back at that same thing. The question is, does it get remanded for another omnibus hearing or a reconsideration of the omnibus hearing, or does it get remanded for trial? I mean, if you reverse the second order, you know, we're standing on the first order. Now, is there going to be a proper notice for reconsideration? Does the court want to reconsider it? Frankly, we didn't ask for reconsideration on this. We went direct to appeal because at this point, we think the judge has already gotten it wrong twice. He got it half wrong the first time and completely wrong the second time.
Are you perhaps not asking us to rule on an issue you raised on appeal, which is determining that the sua sponte raising of that issue is not before us?
Your Honor, I hadn't considered you doing it in that order. My thought was, okay, let's look at the legality of the stop. And if we can determine based upon the record that's in this file that the legality of the stop is one that should have been upheld, then we don't have to get to those issues. And you're looking at it completely the opposite way, saying we have to look at those issues first before we can even look at the legality of the stop. Am I correct in saying that?
Counsel, perhaps rather than having you ask us questions, can I ask you a couple of questions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what I'm here for.
So I have two questions and I'd like you to address them sequentially. And they deal with the sui sponte change in the order. One, what is the best authority you can give us that if the judge had the ability to change his order, he was required to give you notice? So what's the best authority for the notice requirement? And then if there was a requirement and it was error, how is the state prejudiced by the delay, by this, what happened or didn't happen in those 6 months that prejudiced the state?
Well, okay, sequentially, the best authority that we have, Your Honor, is cited in our brief, and let me just review the cases here real quick. The ones that are on that issue, Papadakis says the court does have inherent authority to reconsider an omnibus motion, but on other cases, see, this was a reconsideration without notice, and we couldn't find any case law for authority that said a judge can reconsider that without notice and on a sua sponte motion.
So we couldn't find authority either way. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say, but we looked at other cases where a judge had done something sua sponte and they all said, hey, the an opportunity to respond, whether it be post-conviction,
for a couple of seconds, do you want to repeat
or
lesson?
Whether it be other types of, sure. We looked at other types of cases that went to sua sponte orders, and in those cases, whether it be post-conviction or whether it be dismissal, the courts had said that the judge was wrong to not give the parties an opportunity to respond.
Okay, and could you answer the second part of my question dealing with what happened during these 6 months? Where's the prejudice if this was a mistake? Which it certainly is, at least not best practice.
I don't think there is any prejudice, Your Honor. I mean, we were ready for trial. The evidence is preserved in our evidence room. I think the only perhaps difficulty procedurally at this point is that the court went ahead and dismissed without giving us the opportunity for the oral statement of notice of intent to appeal. And by dismissing, then the bond is gone. I mean, so he's out there. I don't know if there's going to be prejudice if we're going to have to wait for him to be rearrested again. I mean, it was 25 years between this and the last one. So where is this guy? We don't know. And we don't have a bondsman knowing that. So, but there's no prejudice in us being able to prove our case. We've still got all of our evidence.
It's the 6 months didn't present any prejudice is what my question was.
Well, that 6 months didn't present any prejudice to the state in being able to prove our case if the case is allowed to go forward. The prejudice is that we weren't allowed to address any of the court's concerns. The further prejudice is that now we are another 6 months, so we're 7 months removed from the hearing, and the judge's memory is different. You know, he went from it being questionable reliability of the speeding evidence to it being plainly not reliable or some words to that effect. He went from the deputy being credible to the deputy being not credible enough was the language that the court used. And when you use that language, not credible enough and not reliable, really at that point, you're weighing evidence. You're not looking to whether or not the officer has articulated reasonable suspicion, but you're actually weighing evidence. You're not looking to reasonable articulable suspicion. You're looking at reasonable doubt when you start weighing that evidence.
I want to clarify what your arguments are here, but are you, I understand you're saying that you as the state and the parties should have received notice here before he did it. That's one argument you're making, correct?
Correct.
All right. The second issue is, can a judge look back at an order and read it again after 6 months and say, I got this wrong, and change it? Even, I mean, if notice is given, is there any issue with the judge doing that?
No. I think that there is case law that says that a court can reconsider on motion of the parties, and the court has inherent authority to reconsider its own orders. The question here then procedurally becomes, you know, if it's a motion of the parties, obviously we have notice and an opportunity to respond. And when a judge raises a motion sua sponte, again, our argument is we should have opportunity to respond. So there is inherent authority for a court to be able to review its own orders. And there is authority, explicit authority, for a court to reconsider a motion on motion of the parties.
Well, and let me just follow this up, because if this is correct, then you send it back on the basis that you didn't get notice. Can't the judge just do the same thing the judge did before? Because now you get a chance to argue and the judge could come up with the same result, right? How does that help the state's case?
Well, it's absolutely possible that the court could do that. We could make the same arguments to the court that we're doing here. We could move to reopen the hearing for additional evidence. We could actually, in this case, what's highly likely is that we would move to remove the judge for cause. I believe that in the transcript, go ahead, Judge, sorry.
No, your time is up, so just wrap up your thoughts in a few sentences, if you would.
Sure. What would likely happen in that case is there would be a motion to remove the judge for cause, and I believe that the transcript supports that the judge had an active relationship with defense counsel at the time that while this case was pending, and certainly in making that ruling. I mean, he did say, yes, we had a hearing. He was discussing with the city attorney the cost of the hearing. When I asked him if he had an ongoing relationship, he said, yeah. It wasn't until defense counsel said, well, his client was our daughter, or his daughter was our client, that he agreed with that. So, okay. You know, that's what would likely happen on a remand.
Thank you. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Springer.
Thank
counsel
you.
Counsel responded.
We're not hearing.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. And we're only just now starting your time, so.
Thank you. May it please the court, Jeremy Kleinfelter for respondent, Michael McClatchy. This case presents the question of whether the district court clearly erred in its credibility determination of a peace officer when assessing the basis for a traffic stop.
Mr. Kleinfelter, you're going down the same path as the state. You're asking us to determine on the basis of a new order without notice to each of you, and the issue appealed is whether the court sua sponte could go ahead and change its initial finding. And if we agree, we would be sending it back to reinstate the charge, and everything would flow from there. Tell me how you think we can get to the actual issue without going through the procedural requirements.
The procedural issue obviously is before the court. It was raised. In listening to the discussion, some thoughts that I had were, I agree, I could not find a case directly on point for this specific scenario. In reading a number of the cases that I cited, and it went back to that line of cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court, starting with State versus Wheeler, and then moving on to Montjoy, which I cited, as well as Wolin, I believe was a subsequent case. Of course, you know, there's State versus Needham, which is a more current case that comes up frequently in criminal cases. I also read a number of unpublished cases, a number of which I didn't even cite in my brief, So it has come up. The McCarthy case I did cite in my brief, which is an unpublished case where a district court sua sponte reopened an omnibus hearing. In that case, heard by this court, the district court, which the reopening was upheld, the district court did give notice, but the difference in that case was that the district court raised a new legal issue in the intervening time period. And so obviously in a situation like that, based on Needham and the prior Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, the parties would need to be heard. And so there's no dispute from me that had the district court, Judge Kreitzer, sua sponte raised this issue, citing new evidence, new law, you know, something that would require the parties to have an opportunity to be heard, then I think it's a very valid point. I'll happily make that concession. What I kept coming around to in reading these cases and formulating a response to the state's brief, and they primarily cite Lyons and suggest that the standard has to be the same as it is for, when a district court judge overrules a different district court judge. The three things that kept coming up to me were, does the district court have jurisdiction of this case? Number one, it does. The case obviously is still active before the district court. Did the parties have an opportunity to be heard on this narrow issue of the officer's credibility? The answer is unquestionably yes, because we had an omnibus hearing, and that was obviously addressed, and Mr. Springer obviously wanted to address that whole portion in the argument first. And then third, did the ruling cause prejudice? And that's obviously been raised by one of the panel. And the answer is no. The state of Minnesota is in no different position procedurally now than it would have been last August when the original order was issued. There's no new evidence to address. I've never seen any precedent where the state learns that the judge may not find its officer credible, and then they want to reopen the hearing to make a better record, essentially, once they realize that a judge at an omnibus hearing is going to rule against the state and find that the officer is not credible. And that's not being alleged. There's no allegation by the state that there's prejudice to bring the case to trial. No indication that they have additional evidence to submit that they've found in the intervening 6 months.
Yeah, but Mr. Kleinfelter, would you agree though that by virtue of this second order, it made the first order, the finding relative to the speed, it made that order having a critical impact on the state's case? So that issue is appropriately before us.
Yes, it certainly is now. It wasn't back at the time, obviously. Right. I agree.
Yes. Right. So
it is now. But my question is, what is the difference procedurally? If Judge Kreitzer had made this same ruling last August, we'd be in the same position with the state appealing and having an opportunity procedurally be heard in that fashion. And it's not as if the case didn't have the opportunity to be heard now with the second order.
Would you agree though that if in fact you are correct that the judge could do this and he could review his own order and decide that he got it wrong, and that does affect that first order then because it makes it have a critical impact upon the state's case, that it is necessary for us to deal with that issue of whether the judge applied the correct law with regard to the speed issues?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is that procedurally, if this order had occurred last August, the court would be dealing both with the legality of the speed observations as well as the legality of the crossing the center line observation. I agree that both of those issues are now squarely before this court based on the new order, as they would have been last August, no differently. So where's the prejudice? I guess my question at some level is this the best practice? I mean, I've never, I will freely admit, I've never seen this happen. I've been practicing for 16 years, almost exclusively criminal law. I've never heard of this happening before. But when you really, I just keep coming back to those three questions. Does the court have jurisdiction? Did the opponents, did the parties have an opportunity to be heard? And did the ruling prejudice the adverse party? And I think the answer in all of those situations is favorable to simply proceeding, because the state of Minnesota is in no different position procedurally now as it would have been back then.
Mr. Kleinfelter, if I may go to the issue of the what the state says is the undisclosed relationship between defense counsel and the judge. So my questions, and perhaps Mr. Springer could address this on rebuttal too. I mean, was this raised at all in the district court level, before the district court, any motions to recuse made? Is this properly before us?
Well, I think it's properly before you, yes, because it was raised on the record after that procedural hearing in chambers the day after the order, or the new order was issued. And counsel, Mr. Springer, and another prosecutor were present with Attorney Donnelly and the judge in this in-chambers meeting about procedure for the appeal. The judge said, hey, Attorney Donnelly, can you stick around for a second? This conspicuous, right in front of the prosecutors. The judge gave Attorney Springer an opportunity to be heard on the record. A record was created. The state of Minnesota did not file any additional requests to create more of a record after that record was made. The state of Minnesota did not file a motion with the chief judge for disqualification. The state of Minnesota basically in an indirect way in its brief, raised the issue by citing, one case, the Peterson case, which really isn't on point factually.
But isn't it different here? I mean, why would the state be filing with the chief judge for a new judge where this was raised after the decision was made?
Normally, I would
look at things and say, well, you have to ask the chief judge first. But I mean, I can understand it, that this is an unusual situation.
Sure, but the state has the opportunity under the case law to toll the proceedings and file a motion for reconsideration or file a motion with the chief judge to address that issue if it feels it's warranted.
But we're not there yet, are we? I mean, we haven't decided the outcome of this. Why would we be touching on whether or not a judge should recuse? That's not a motion that anybody's presented. I guess that's what I'm getting at, is this properly before us? I may have been part of the weight of the argument in terms of the sua sponte nature, but that's what we're deciding, is whether or not this order can stand or whether we would reinstate the charge. I guess anybody can ask for recusal or removal at that point. So is it properly before us? Has it been raised?
Well, all I can do is respond to the state's argument, which the state raises the issue, obviously. A record was made. I agree that the state didn't make a formal argument to the district court, but the state seems to be raising the issue in its brief. And
I guess, Mr. Kleinfelter, what I'm getting at is if the state received Judge Kreitzer's order, and instead of appealing that order, filed a motion to have Judge Kreitzer step off or recuse based on all that, that's an issue that I don't see us dealing with because it didn't happen.
Yeah, and that's part of my point, is that, so why are we addressing that issue?
That's what I'm asking you. Are we addressing that issue or not?
I don't think we should. I mean, part of my point is if a prosecutor is going to raise this issue, you would hope that it would be, you know, well thought out, well researched, and well executed. And that just, none of those are present with this particular issue. It seems to be getting raised haphazardly in the brief. And I agree essentially that the court should just rule on the merits. And if the court rules in favor of my client, we're done. Procedurally. But I mean, I do feel I obviously that I have to respond since it was raised in the appellant's brief. But yes, I agree that procedurally it wasn't raised in probably the best way.
You know, what we overlook is the fact the first time this was in front of Judge Kreitzer, his ruling was the center line was enough to tip this on for probable cause. At that time, way back when, he didn't agree with the speeding. Now, the state did not bring that up on appeal in its statement that this was critical impact. So now we move on to a new sua sponte order that has to do with going over the center line, or the line, and that's critical impact because that's the only thing the state had. So I don't know how we can address all of this without addressing the order that we're faced with right now. I mean, I'd like to take a look at the speeding, but how do we do that? That one goes back to the first order.
Yeah, and I guess my that is a technicality that frankly, I think went beyond my consideration. I feel like the issue is properly raised on both the speed observation and the centerline observation for the procedural reason that you've just raised, in that the state of Minnesota had no opportunity back in August to raise that speed observation issue for the obvious reason that critical impact could not have occurred at that time. I think I just essentially conceded that both issues are squarely before the court at this time, in my view, based on how this proceeded procedurally, because the second order didn't eliminate the first order. The second order was, you know, essentially an addendum procedurally, reversing that portion, now making critical impact an issue. And so I think both the speed observation and the centerline observation, the credibility determination, is squarely before the court procedurally at this point. And I say that respectfully because I understand what you're saying procedurally, but I don't see why this court would want to remand just for the district court to say, I'm not sure what the district court would say because clearly
maybe that's what an error correcting court does. Oh, that's not a question, that's just a statement.
So Mr. Klinefelter, yeah. Your time is up, but I do want to ask the panel if they have additional questions for you.
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Springer, rebuttal.
Judge, Mr. Klinefelter raised prejudice to the state, saying that, you know, there's nothing more that the state could have done that they didn't already have an opportunity to do. But that's not exactly true. Before the district court, the defendant, the respondent, did not argue credibility at all. In fact, they conceded credibility in saying that the officer did have three reasons, but he only gave one, and that one wasn't reliable enough because it was showing 59 out of 60, and that's not a violation of the law. So they didn't argue credibility. Credibility was not an issue. That was only an issue when the judge made that an issue. We would have been able to argue had they been talking about the deputy's credibility, the Florence issues that we look at, which then gets to the Schulberg, which applies that Florence credibility standard to reasonable articulable suspicion cases. I don't think Schulberg was cited in either brief, but Schulberg, 387 Northwest 2nd 225, basically applies that, saying, hey, look, if there wasn't contested testimony, if there wasn't conflicting testimony, we don't even look at credibility. We make a determination as a matter of law if these facts are reasonable, articulable suspicion. And there was no conflicting testimony, but we weren't free to argue that because that was not brought up by the defense. We could have argued that before the state or before the court, district court, but the judge, sua sponte, reconsidered and found based upon credibility, which he shouldn't even have been addressing. So there was prejudice to the state. Now, did the state bring a motion to recuse the judge? No. And the reason for that is we didn't find out about the relationship until after the case had been dismissed by the court. The case was dismissed by the court on Thursday. Friday morning, we go in to talk about whether we should have kept it on so that we can give the notice of the oral notice of appeal that's required by the rules of criminal procedure. And then immediately after that hearing, the judge goes into an ex parte conference with defense counsel. That's when we started asking questions. And that's when, you know, we made that transcript saying, whoa, this looks like an impropriety, judge. Convince us it's not. And what instead he convinced us was it was an impropriety. You know, at that point, we no longer have a case in which to bring any kind of motion. So we appeal to get our case back. And if it gets remanded before the same judge, at that point, you can certainly expect that there will be that motion. So that's why no motion was made, because we didn't have a case. And at the point where the case is reinstated by the court, which actually, if you look at the district court record, occurred after we had filed our notice of appeal, you know, the court said, you know, now it's stayed. Well, it hadn't been stayed before. It was just out dismissed.
We didn't. Mr. Springer, would you agree then that that matter is not properly before us now?
Your Honor, I'm going back to the Judge Amundson case. And I'm looking at that Judge Amundson case, and I don't think either party raised it there in the Court of Appeals saying, hey, Judge Amundson, you shouldn't be hearing this. I think that was only found out later, as is the case here. It was only found out later that Ryder Bennett, who was arguing that, was an attorney for the trust that he was the trustee of. And in this case, it was only found out later that Mr. Kleinfelter and Mr. Donnelly are the attorneys for the judge's daughter, and the judge is participating in hearings with them.
I guess what I'm getting at is we don't have a ruling on that, and we are an error-correcting court, so how would we be able to address an issue that there has been no ruling on, absent of going back, you raising the issue, and then perhaps disagreeing with what the outcome is?
And that's very possible, Judge. But the way that I looked at it is I don't think the Supreme Court had that. So they were correcting an error, but the error wasn't raised in the court below. You know, I've got 30 seconds left, and I can't add too much more. I wanted to get to that credibility that we weren't able to argue. And Judge Jessen, you did request that I address why there was no motion. If there's nothing further from the judges, thank you.
Well, thank you both so much for your helpful arguments in this matter. The court will take this under advisement, and a decision will be issued within the statutory time period. And with that, the court is in recess.